Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and you're listening to the AR Library and EMS call, Q&A call. And it's December 9th, 2013. I apologize for being a couple of minutes late here. And we've got a bunch of questions today, so let me get started. The first one, how could I have been so stupid? I made a mistake of going on a forum one time after I learned of my husband's affair where the other woman, other women were talking about their relationships with married men. Most of them had no problem sleeping with a married man. And while what they said disgusted me, I looked because I seemed to think I could figure out how this woman could have an affair with my husband for more than a year, maybe longer, but he won't admit that, and never seemed to regret a moment of it. I also tried to figure out how I could have been so stupid. I think of this every single day. How could I not have known he was sneaking out, not at work when he said he was, talking to her every single day for up to 2 hours or more? How could I have been so stupid? While I try to live life with my held head high because my family says I should, inside I'm in a constant fetal position. I doubt every single thing I do and everything everyone says to me. I don't trust anyone anymore. I trusted and got hurt and hurt bad. I was made a fool out of at least a year, 3 years actually, because that's how long she said they were talking every day. I used to be pretty carefree and trusting and accepting. Now, I don't even trust God to take care of me. When I let go of my need for control over some medical issue, I thought God would take care of me. Instead, my husband has been having an affair, and I found out. I trusted God with all of this, and I got pregnant. I trusted him to keep the baby safe, and a week ago, I had a miscarriage. Not only has this shattered my self-worth, my trust in myself, and my faith in my husband, it's shaken my faith to the core. So, is this a question? Yes. I guess my question is simply, how could I have been so stupid to trust and to believe, to have faith at all? By the way, I'm 4 months into all of this, and I'm not sure I can keep going, even though my husband has been doing all that he should in going to a counselor and talking to our pastor, etc. Well, to begin, I just want you to know how pained I am for everything you're going through. I mean, I hate that this has happened. I mean, I can't believe it. It's got to be horrible for you. You know, when you trust someone, that's not necessarily stupid. It's really not. I think it takes a lot of courage to be able to love. To love is to risk. If someone takes advantage of us and what we've done, or, you know, takes advantage of us and our love, then in the long run, we're not the fool. They're the fool for taking advantage of something that probably was the best thing that they'd ever had. But instead of appreciating what they've had, they choose to do something foolish. And I don't know. You know, you sit there and say, I guess my question is, how could I have been so stupid? I don't think you were stupid. I think you were loving, and it's a big difference. You know, one of the things that C.S. Lewis says, and I've always appreciated, is that the only way you can ever keep your heart safe from the perturbations of love, from people doing the wrong thing, is hell. It's the only place you can keep it safe is in hell, where you're completely isolated and cut off from others. The person that was abnormal here wasn't you, and you weren't stupid. Now, at this point, what you do from here I don't know. I mean, it's if your husband's doing the right things, possibly it would be stupid not to at least see what's going to happen and if there's something worth salvaging. On the other hand, one of your problems is, for all of us, it's pride and dignity. When someone takes advantage of us, it's our pride that somehow, you know, we fear what others will think of us. And the one thing you might explore is the image management, is what others think one of the things that drive your fear of being stupid? Because it's not stupid to love. It may be stupid to put yourself back in a situation where somebody isn't changed if you don't feel like there's a possibility of things being different. But so often what really bothers us, I think, or at least some people I've talked to, is what others think of them because they were fooled or what they at least think others would think of them. In our culture, we're far more tolerant of divorce than we are of someone deciding to look at a marriage and see if there's anything worth salvaging. And oftentimes it's swimming against cultural streams to even consider doing something different. So at one level, I don't think you a fool to stay, nor do I think you a fool if you, or I don't think you a fool to leave, nor would I think you a fool if you decided to stay and be a part of your husband's restoration, if he's going to do it. I mean, I don't know. You know, why would you have faith at all? To me, faith is not an issue of believing, receiving. Faith is a matter of how long you can believe and receive nothing. Our faith isn't the thing that creates the work of God any more than my eyes are the things that create light or my ears are the things that create sound. My faith perceives the work of God in the same way that my eyes perceive light and my ears perceive sound. If you're able to look at this and go, God may be doing something here, I think you can find peace, you know, that God may be up to something. On the other hand, if you judge it and say there's nothing good here, or you can see nothing but negatives, and in the long run, it would seem hopeless. And all I know is that God's greatest miracle is taking the worst thing that ever happened and making it the best. And my prayer for you is that he'll be able to take this and somehow redeem it and make it something that brings life instead of death. Again, I'm just so sorry that you're involved in all of this and that you're in this place. My prayers will be with you. Next question. I did it. Contact with the affair partner. First, my resolve to reconcile and heal my marriage is stronger than ever. While everything says don't do it, I've recently been in contact with my wife's affair partner to the point that we hung out together several hours. It was actually a relief for both of us. He shared with me all of the text communications between them for several weeks. What I learned about her was not hearsay. I read it with my own eyes, a glimpse inside her sad mind. This served to further increase my empathy for her as someone who's an addicted friend and loved one. She told him we had not had sex in over 2 years. She's been promising him that her marriage is completely over and that she would never be able to move back home, that we were working together to split our finances and decide custody for our kids. Meanwhile, she continues to see a counselor at AR and participates in the weekly Beyond EMS conference calls. On the day of that discovery, she told him she was at work all day in meetings and she was really at counseling. Upon learning this, he was shocked and angry at how badly he had been deceived. The result was that he broke off the affair, I am told. He confronted her with her lies and told her it was over. When she asked him how he learned the truth, he told her that her husband, me, had recorded and shared a phone conversation about her affair counseling session, proving that she was working towards saving the marriage. He told me, when I break it off and she asks me how I know she's been lying, I will make up something so she doesn't know you're part of it. But I said no. I encouraged him just to tell the truth. Everything for 5 months has been pure lies and deception. I refused to be a part of that. After he dropped the hammer, she called me hurt and said the things that I do like. She called me hurt and said the things that I do like this only serve, when I do things like this, it only serves to drive her further from us. Question is that true? Have I severely damaged our chances of recovery because of this? Well, so the answer to the first question, is it true that it drives someone further away if they feel like you're trying to control and manipulate the recovery process and take away their choices? Absolutely. Partially because if someone does something because they have no other alternative, is it really just something they have to do, or is it something they choose to do? And you really want it to be out of desire. So in a sense, there are several problems with affair partners that I've found through the years when people have been in contact. And one of them is simply, I wouldn't expect the affair partner to be truthful any more than I would expect someone in an affair to be truthful. Both at one level are trying to do their own image management. Second, even communication that occurs in an affair oftentimes isn't true. People will say what they need to say in order to keep their addiction going, which means it's not necessarily truth. And even when you read things, that's the problem with reading emails and text frequently, is that it's actually more distorted than what you are even being told at that point. Second, if he truly does stick to the no contact, how does him ending it rather than her impact the timing and chances of recovery? That would be very difficult to say. I think that, again, if someone is forced into something they don't want, oftentimes the anger can prolong things, but it would just depend on how the person ultimately sees it over time. And sometimes the heart longs, you know, it's almost like the person who wants the relationship the least always has the most power. So if someone goes to a no-contact position, it frequently will make them long for the relationship more rather than seeing why they needed to dump the relationship. I mean, it can go the other way, but that's certainly one of the ways it can backfire. How does her knowing that I was part of the breaking up of her affair impact the timing and chances of recovery? Every case is individual, so I would have no way of actually knowing how to even answer that. Potentially it can create communication, and potentially it can create more bitterness and resentment. Typically when a woman's in an affair, there's already an issue with resentment, and so to the extent that they can begin to see you in a different light, it's really helpful. So if one of the ways that you've been viewed previously has been as controlling and manipulative, then this would only serve to reinforce that viewpoint rather than helping shift the viewpoint. Let's see. If she persuades him into going back to her, how does that impact her decision to start the 90-day program? Again, it's somebody that wants to do a 90-day cutoff The reason they do a 90-day cutoff is because it's a unilateral decision. It's something they decide they want to do. So obviously they still have to come to a place where they want to do the 90-day program. It just kind of stalls or delays the ability to enter that sort of thing. In question five, my counselor told me she will not commit to true reconciliation until she finds herself on an island with no one to turn to except God. Is there truth to this, and would we be right to believe that God is strongly knocking on her door right now? Well, I think I tell people frequently that there's it's not a choice between a mate or an affair partner. It's a choice between there's a third option. It's a choice between self or God, whatever you want to call it, and the current situation. So at one level, you know, the problem is, you know, whenever affair partners and mates get together and start trying to talk and control and manipulate, they get the focus onto the wrong thing for the spouse in recovery. Right now, the spouse needs to be trying to figure out that there's something more important. It's an internal problem they've got to work through. So is it, you know, would it be true to believe that God strongly knocked on the door? From a spiritual perspective, I can tell you one of the things Jesus says is he's standing at the door knocking all the time. So I don't see how that would even change. Next question. Events are certainly fluid through this process. This is a continuation from the previous. While her affair partner is adamant that he is done, he will not cut off contact. So we know it's not done. She's told on him as much as the other way around. I thought bucking the coach's call and throwing the Hail Mary on this might work. However, it's another realization that your literature and experience and rules are spot on. One more thing that I might just say about contacting the or even trying to control and manipulate your mate into doing the right thing. It usually doesn't work very well. Like I said, the affair partner, why we would believe the affair partner for our mate is always, to me, a little confusing. And for most couples, there's not a Hail Mary, maybe for a small percentage, but generally, this is just a process couples go through, and it requires a great deal of patience. And I believe over time, you certainly haven't damaged things irreparably, and maybe in your own process through this, you come to the place where you're able to let go of control. I mean, at one strange level, you have to let go of control to gain control, and I hope this is helping you to let go so that you can find some peace as you go forward. Next question. Questions about 90-day contracts. I listened to a Q&A back in April where an unfaithful woman asked about how it is possible to fall back in love. She quoted your interview with the pastor of how a woman is typically completely out of love with her mate when she first strays. You go on to explain that the first step is breaking off the affair and doing the 90-day no contact. Only then can the process of relationships healing ever begin. Did I understand that only after 90 days is it possible, is there a possibility of the cheating spouse coming back? So let me answer that first. Not at all. Not everybody even has to have 90 days. Some people know what they want. And the 90-day piece is if somebody is ambivalent and they're confused as to which way they want to go and they're having trouble making a decision. and they're going back and forth between the two possibilities. What I try to accomplish in the 90 days is to actually stop the current destructive cycle of going back and forth, which is currently being reinforced. I mean, breaking off the affair just becomes a part of the cycle. So you need a new choice besides either making up or breaking up. And the new choice is no contact for 90 days. That's a different choice than making up or breaking up. So it's finding a different pathway. And ultimately, that's what you want to accomplish. And let's see, second question here. My wife's affair continues, and she has not lived in our home for a couple of months. I have no idea of when the 90-day process may start or what it looks like. What I'm trying to understand and prepare myself for is, what does that look like for me? Does she continue to live away from home for those 90 days? Do we continue to be strangers for these 90 days? Is communication with me about this 90 days with me about this 90 days part of the plan? Will I ever know when it starts? Will I know when or if she fails and has to start over? Are there exercises for the two spouses to work on during the 90 days? So the 90-day contract, when I have somebody do 90 days, is oftentimes it can look very different depending on a particular situation. For some people, it really is a personal journey. They don't even need to be working on the marriage at that point. They need to be working on themselves and just completely get out of looking to relationships and figuring out how to look to something completely different, to a higher power. But they've got to find a different source for life. For some people, the 90 days ends up being a time period for at least giving the marriage a fair shake before they make a decision to leave the marriage, since, you know, the affair began in secret. I can tell you there are many different ways that the 90 days has looked, as I've worked with couples through the years. Would you know? Probably you wouldn't necessarily know. You would know that it's safe. You would know that they're working on something, but the thing is, the 90 days isn't for you as much as it is for your mate. And so normally, the 90 days is really something that's happening, but not something that's being, it's not a point of communication or a point of talk, because you want them focused on something different. So if the part of the 90 days is about talking about, have you decided, which, you know, I think a lot of hurt spouses would want the conversation to be about, then it would be counterproductive, only because all you're doing is perpetuating the same pattern that you were trying to break by beginning the 90-day cutoff to begin with. So in that sense, normally the 90 days is really something for the hurt spouse, I mean the unfaithful spouse, for their recovery plan. And it's something that allows them to begin to gain perspective so that they can make better decisions as they go forward. Then here it says, as you might imagine, it is challenging. As you might imagine, it is challenging to continue supporting the recovery process if I know without doubt I will continue to be unloved, single dad, no spouse, at the very least for 3 months. Help me understand. Hopefully, if your mate's changing and making decisions and doing something different, at that point there really is hope. And I would believe also, as the two of you continue in your recovery work, that you'll find that you'd have probably a lot more peace and even better communication over time. It's just that what you talk about becomes very important. It needs to be something that's going to be productive and not get you stuck back into the old patterns of what had been happening. This old conversations about fair partner, whatever. Next question. Hysterical bonding. Do you have any articles on hysterical bonding or the desire for increased sex after finding out about an affair, and if there are ways to continue that, such as learning more about your spouse and his needs, etc.? I'm actually enjoying this newfound passion between us, but also within me. I don't really want to let it go. If you haven't yet, maybe you can do an article on it. I'll also search the library for more information. So it's typical for couples immediately after an affair when they come back together to have a very strong bond, and it's almost like there's something they realize that's very precious, and for the person who's been unfaithful, the fact that their mate would be loving to them after everything they've done, it truly is unconditional love. You can never be loved unconditionally as long as you only conditionally let your mate know who you are. And the fact that you've let them know who you are and the fact that ultimately they still love you is a profound part of love. At the same time, for the person who's been betrayed, knowing that their mate wants to be with them and certainly, you know, they want to express, you know, their own love. There's just a lot of expressions of love that happen at this point. And what I think is interesting is your question. I don't really want to go. It's difficult to sustain that level of passion because part of what is driving the passion for the two of you at this point is the circumstances created by the ending of an affair. Certainly don't want to sustain it by having other affairs, but there are really healthy things you can do to grow the marriage, to go to a deeper type of bonding between the two of you. And frequently I'll mention a book I have couples do together, which is Peter and Tenner's book, Restoring the Pleasure, which I think is very good. Also, if you haven't done EMS online or EMS weekend, something like that, and also maybe give you some ideas of ways to stay connected. Mostly, it's just making sure your relationship is truly healed and you're both committed to doing the work to continue to grow this thing. One of the pieces I believe about marriage is that entropy, or, you know, that whole thing of the second law of thermodynamics is so prevalent. I mean, you'll never get as much out of a marriage as you put into it. Marriages take ongoing work. And the way to sustain and keep things moving is to continue to pour into the marriage through years and through time, making sure that you cherish what the two of you have together and you grow together. Through that work through the years, that you don't allow the children, for instance, to draw you away from one another, to drain energy out of that marriage as husband and wife, that you have to go beyond just the role of mom and dad and continue to nurture what the two of you have and to find time to be together and to enjoy one another. And I do hope that you'll continue doing the necessary work to keep moving forward. And then last question for the day, I believe. Follow-up from November 18th, week 5, confusion. Hello. I sent a Q&A back on the 18th with my past, so you would remember, 9 years and 7 affairs and hundreds of lies from my ex-drug addict workaholic husband. 2 in the past 4 years since we found God and changed our lives. Well, I'm still struggling. We just did week 8. And I'm feeling worse than before we started the course, almost. I had such high hopes each week that he would learn something that can salvage our marriage. It's something that can salvage our marriage. He's done every assignment and has done them well, but nothing carries over into our everyday life. We are stuck in pretend normal, and I don't know if we can ever heal. I mentioned before, I don't know if this is PTSD from so much trauma, but before we found God, I stayed because I had fear of being alone, codependent, no matter what he did. Now, I still find the closer I get to God, the higher my wall is getting to my husband. Everything he does annoys me. I have absolutely no respect for him. And this week, when it asks what I admire, I don't know anymore. I can't even remember if I ever admired anything, or was I just in this relationship because of partying to start and codependency later. And so much hurt. The scars are deep, and I worry I'll never respect him. I don't think I ever did to begin with. So how do you learn to respect someone who's destroyed your heart? God has taught me that I don't need my husband to fill my heart. So the more I realize I can just be loved by God, then I have no reason to have someone who hurt me so much around. Yes, I can forgive, but respect, not possible. He still continues to show me daily he can't empathize with anything, not just affair hurt, but things he does in an evening that hurts. I share, and he defends his actions and doesn't show any empathy. Am I wasting time? And is his pretending discourse will help him empathize or help me earn respect for him that I never had to start? So is it going to help you earn a respect that you never had to start with? I'm lost. You know, what's hard, I remember one woman telling me once that she knew there had to be one or two things positive about her mate. There must be, because she married him. But for the life of her, she said it took over a year before she was able to think of anything positive about her mate. And I find that's not uncommon. You know, even something you said here, and it may be right. We're stuck in pretend normal. You were saying that nothing carries over from the week. Everything he does annoys me. I have absolutely no respect. The things I used to admire, I don't. One of the things that happens when someone's lens is very, very negative, it's almost as if the other person can't do anything right. At one level, even if he does something good, there's a possibility even that annoys you, or you attribute the most negative motive or potentially discount it for some wrong motivation. So it's difficult, I think, in a place where you're as hurt as you are. I would also say, though, at one level, things have to be getting better just because you're allowed or you're somehow able to have feelings that maybe you haven't been able to have. It sounds like the hurts and the scars really are deep, and it seems that you don't have a clue how you could ever care or develop respect for him again in the future. That probably would take a miracle. I would say the only way you'll know probably is a little bit through time and through your new faith, asking God to reveal things to you. If you get a little farther beyond the pain, maybe you can gain some clarity. One of the things I know that you would have to be able to see, obviously, is consistency on his part, being safe. We naturally feel what irritates us. We have to be intentional to see what we appreciate and to even see something in him, even if it's minuscule growth, is probably going to take intentionality on your part, just a willingness to say, okay, God, show me, is there anything there? Is he doing anything different? A lot of times when we speak in overgeneralization, such as he does nothing, nothing carries on from this week, there's nothing that I admire, when we tell ourselves things such as there's nothing I admire or nothing carries forward, we will feel as if there's nothing carrying forward. It takes a lot of, I think, rigorous honesty to really look and see if there is change, because there's a possibility that there's change, but the part of you that's afraid of the relationship is also afraid to acknowledge the frame or to acknowledge the change or even small behavioral changes, simply because there's a part of you that doesn't want to be hurt again. And that's very, very understandable, why you wouldn't want to open yourself up even to the possibility that change may be there. It may be that, you know, it's too much for you, and that's fine. You've put up with a lot through the years. I would still suggest finishing the course and see, you know, is he going to continue, is he going to work at trying to get better himself? Is he going to work at trying to understand you and trying to help you heal? Or is he going to do kind of bare minimum requirements? If he's not really willing to do work here, I don't know how this thing could really continue, because you need a whole lot of intensive care right now after everything you've gone through. And he needs to really be focused on becoming somebody you can respect. If all he's trying to do is save the marriage, I would tell you I don't think it's safe. If he's trying to become the man he thinks God really wanted him to be and trying to help you heal, that would be a little bit better. But if he's back to trying to save the marriage, I can tell you that's going to be about his codependency. So I don't know that I have completely answered your question. I just know that you're in a hard place and I feel horrible for you. Sometimes it's going to take time. I know that 2 months, 8 weeks seems like an eternity. And I will also tell you that it's a very short period of time in this process. But I also don't want you to settle for what you once had either. And this is so much about his journey. Is he going to do the work he needs to do for him? Because if he's doing that, then maybe he can be somebody for you. But if he's not doing the work for himself, helping himself grow and figuring out what's at the core of this, then I don't know that he could ever be safe for you. So I do wish you well, and just stay with the course. Things aren't over yet, but give it a little bit of time. You might try Beyond EMS or the Married for Life course afterwards a little while as you continue to grow. And maybe you can at least learn as much as you can before you leave the relationship. I'll just be hoping and praying that you get clarity and kind of come out of this confusion about what needs to happen, but have the courage to look and see if maybe there's a little change. I don't know if there's hope or not, but you're the only one who can ask God to show you. My prayers again will be with you. That's all of our questions for today. I want to thank everybody for joining the call, and I hope everybody has a good week, and I look forward to talking to you again next week to healing.